Welcome to Healthcare Crossroads, a podcast showcasing the connections we make in healthcare data, compliance, and patient care. We are at a crossroads in healthcare. Let's make an impact by bringing together physicians, nurses, healthcare information management professionals, and legal experts in healthcare. Everyone in healthcare intersects. Let's find out how. This is Healthcare Crossroads. Here is your host, Jennifer McNamara.
Hello and welcome to the Healthcare Crossroads podcast. My name is Jennifer McNamara and I am your host today. I want to thank you for coming back and listening to our show. We have another great episode in store for you today. To all our listeners out there, how was your weekend? I want to know how your weekend was. I had an amazing weekend with family and friends. I was able to recharge, to get some rest, and to refocus. Think about this last year, this year of 2022, all the challenges, the goals I've had, and solutions I've been able to bring forth to many challenges in healthcare, and also my goals for 2023. What are your goals? Mine personally is in January. I am actually starting the year out. I am sitting for my CDEO exam, Clinical Documentation Expert Outpatient. I just love digging into documentation. I love seeing the clinical side, what they do, such important things they do, and how on the business side, I can be of assistance. And those of us out there who really love what we do on the business side, we love working with our clinical teams. And as a team, we are a team, helping our patients to get the needed services that they need and understand this complex industry we have. You know, in this country, healthcare is complex. There's no denying that. You can go to other countries and you can see various differences in how patients get access to care and how much they have to pay for care in other countries. But in this country, so complex. We have to understand the complexities to a certain degree. And in this day and age, we know patients are given more education. They're given more information about their own care, their documentation, access to their medical records. So it does create some unique challenges for us on the clinical and business sides. But as the business side, we know how important education is. We know we love to stay educated. We have to stay educated to keep our credentials, right? Guess what? So do those on the clinical side. Those on the clinical side value education as well. So we're here to talk today to a very special friend of mine. I have many friends that are surgeons and physicians that I've kept in touch with over the years. And over the last couple of years, I've had the privilege of meeting and getting to know an amazing surgeon that I'll get to share my interview with you today that I had recently with Dr. Michael Cross. Dr. Cross is a surgical oncologist who focuses on the diagnosis and treatment of breast cancer. He is a board-certified surgeon with the American Board of Surgery, and Dr. Cross has had an amazing career. I personally have had the opportunity to learn a lot from him that has helped me grow professionally. Now, just a little bit about him and his amazing career. I'll hit the highlights for you. He is the surgical director of the Arkansas Breast Cancer Specialists, and they recently received a three-year accreditation from the National Accreditation Program for Breast Centers, awarded, of course, under the direction of the American College of Surgeons. He served as co-director of the School of Oncoplastic Surgery. Locally here in the state of Arkansas, of course, Dr. Cross was born and raised right here in the state of Arkansas. He has served on numerous committees and boards for various breast cancer foundations and institutes. And of course, he was previously appointed, as many know here in Arkansas, by Governor Mike Huckabee to the Oversight Committee for Breast Cancer Research in the state of Arkansas. We can learn so much from Dr. Cross. And so for those of you out there, I just encourage you, before we get into this interview, think about some of the surgeons you've worked with, their physicians you've worked with. Take advantage of the education that they can offer you. Have conversations with them. Get to know them. And I think you're really going to enjoy this interview, this look into the life of Dr. Cross, what he is like as a person, and also his passion that carries through in everything he does as he takes care of his patients every day. So stay tuned for my interview with Dr. Cross. The barriers for practices and patients due to prior authorizations are a clinical and clerical issue. I want to thank OncoSpark for designing a platform that streamlines and standardizes the authorization process. This optimizes staff and resources while decreasing the time a patient must wait. The platform will seamlessly integrate with your practice management system and electronic medical record, alerting you to expiring authorizations or order changes. Off-parency's reports can be used for internal development as well as payer and pharma accountability. Direct insurance verification and specialty pharmacy hub enrollment are standard modules in the platform too. So jump on over to authparency.com. That's www.authparency.com and get started today with this amazing tool. Well, as mentioned, I have a very special guest on the show today. I have Dr. Michael Cross. Dr. Cross, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jennifer. Good to be here.
Well, I know we've had some great conversations over the last couple of years about just some challenges that we all face, and especially physicians face in caring for patients, getting reimbursed for their services. So we'll talk about some of those challenges today. But I always like to, when I have a guest on, kind of do some icebreaker questions, our listeners, to get to know you a little bit better. So let me ask you, you're a person, you like to do fun stuff. So what is the one place you've never traveled to that you still want to go visit, Dr. Cross?
I think on the top of my list, I am a cyclist and have a road bike, and I enjoy riding throughout all of our trails and system here. But I really would like to go to Italy more. Actually, Sicily, and do a biking trip where they have a van that comes along with you and they feed you. You may go up and down these hills, 40, 50, 60 kilometers a day with a group of other cyclists. And then you get to stay in bed and breakfasts, and they have food along the way. It may take you 8 hours, but for like 9 to 10 hours a day, that's what you're doing.
And that's
it seems,
amazing.
It seems grueling, but it's in another land, another country, and it's just so intriguing to me.
That's wonderful. That's actually on my list as well. I have family that's visited there, and I see pictures, and I just want to go there so bad. So I love that. Well, let me ask you this: in your free time, if you ever have any, I know you're super busy as a surgeon. Do you like to go to any games? Are you a sports person? Do you like restaurants? What do you like to do?
Yeah, I think if I have free time, I love to go on walks. I do attend some sporting events, but most of what I do, it's just activity. Simple things like chopping wood. And I live on 7 acres, and so there's always things to do. Yards to mow. I'm just a routine, everyday worker at home. And it's joyful for me to take care of my own spread.
I love that. I think that's what we all enjoy. Like we naturally enjoy taking care of our home and, the things that we have that we work so hard for. Well, let's talk about the work that you do, Dr. Cross. Very important work. We know you're a surgeon, specifically for breast and oncology. How long have you been a surgeon?
Well, that's scary. So I've done breast only since 1993. So we're coming up on nearly, come October 2023, 30 years.
Wow.
Of doing surgical oncology of the breast.
Well, that's amazing. You have a lot of experience. You've helped a lot of patients, and there's still challenges, I'm sure, every day. What drives you every day to continue this work? There's a lot of physicians out there have left the practice of medicine and doing this because of burnout. But I wanted to kind of get your thoughts, with this thought. Have you ever felt that pressure, and what helps you continue to go on?
Yeah, the pressure is there. If all you looked at was the bottom line of what you do, what you produce and all that, it would be completely frustrating because we don't make the same amount of income we did, even 5 years ago. However, I have a great team of nurses that help me every day. My specific breast cancer team or surgical oncology team, they are fun to work with. Mm-hmm. They are exciting, they get up, and they are full of passion. And the joy of us, it's grueling. I mean, I did two operations this week. One, it was 6 hours of total surgery. You come back, you do seven patients, post-op patients from previous several weeks. It's just a joy of seeing them heal, get back into life. We have 90-year-olds that we help. We have 20-year-olds that we help. And it is that drive to see them get back into life. And their strength gives me great passion to keep doing it because they are amazing people.
Now, when I think about what has happened since 2020, we've been going through it, a lot of challenges. And your practice specifically, you know, what did you have to overcome during the pandemic compared to maybe prior? What are some of the challenges that were unique during the pandemic to a practice like yours?
I think just the loss of, I think there's such great fear among our patients. And not only was breast cancer, but this unknown, unseeable virus that they were really, really afraid of. But we never stopped. Because of our specialty, we continued to just push through. And so there was a time where I don't think I went anywhere for a solid year. It was just work. And so the patients, it seemed like, you know, they were down and out mentally and spiritually and then financially. Some had lost their jobs. And so those were deep, deep challenges for us. And then the fatigue factor for our whole team was real. You're constantly, you know, wearing a mask, which obstructs your ability to just think clearly. And you seem to be operating longer hours, different hours. But, you know, we kind of made it through that. We're better on this side of it.
I think so, too. We've learned a lot from maybe even just the processes that we have in place for a situation like this and how if we encounter the situation in the future, we'll be better prepared for what to expect, yeah. I think. Now, it's important to, of course, get reimbursed for the important services that you provide. So when you think about the business staff that you've had over the years, how has that affected your ability to care for your patients? What does that do for you?
Well, first of all, we don't keep our doors open. So we can't serve our population if we don't have just incredible people working the books and following the rules and regulations that are set up by insurance companies and all that. So we have to dig deeper, work harder, and work smarter. Otherwise, no one can really balance their life really well. If you're working all the time and you're not properly billing and coding, you won't stay in practice very long. So the team that I work with are unbelievable, and you were part of that. So that was amazing to have people who are knowledgeable, know how to do the correct coding and the correct and how what the regulations are. But you need each other. This is something you cannot do alone.
Absolutely. Teams are teams. And I work very closely with a lot of physicians, just building those relationships. You know, I'm a huge physician advocate, which is why when I meet physicians like yourself, it encourages me to see physicians that practice ethical medicine that really want to make a difference, but also follow those regulations that we all have to follow. It would be really nice if patients could afford all of the healthcare that they need, or we were in a system where that wasn't an issue. We know in some countries, patients don't have to worry about healthcare. It's not even a question. They can walk into a hospital and get cared for without having to worry about, is my insurance going to cover this? Mm-hmm. So in a perfect world like that, if it was a situation where we didn't have to worry about that, we would be great. But because we do have to rely on these insurance payers to cover the cost for our patients, it's important that we have teams in place, right, that understand these rules and can explain it in a way that a physician can still understand their role in it, but their focus can be on taking care of the patient. So as an ethical physician yourself, we know you want to cover the cost, but your goal is to really make sure your patients have quality outcomes from their care. Sometimes cost does become more important and organizations have to cover their costs. But where do you think we can meet costs and keep a high level of quality, in your opinion?
Well, it's the little things. And we learn from our patients. Now, but to be honest, it's been, it seems like the cancer is a little bit bigger lately. They're more complicated. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of sicker people. A lot of, you know, we continue to see people who smoke. There's obesity, there's diabetes. So our general health is not stellar. And so when you operate on unhealthy people, you have to come up with a better plan, because any complications, even though it's their comorbid factors, it looks, it reflects on you. For instance, so if they are diabetic and they're poorly controlled, we have to make sure that their blood sugars are better controlled than in the 400 or 500 range. Or if they smoke, we have to teach them, listen, cut down on smoking, and then we'll do several antibacterial showers. Sometimes we'll let them shower, you know, 2 or 3 days with this soap before surgery, the morning of surgery. And one of the biggest things that I do is I see them every week for 6 weeks in a row, that particular patient. And that makes for long clinics. However, if you catch things early, it's so much better than to wait a month and then see them and then it's too late. Uh-huh. So a lot of the things we do are preemptive. Education plays a huge part of what I do. I do a lot of breast surgery. There's a lot of drains. We teach them with all kinds of props. We show them what the drain looks like. We show them how to strip the drain, how to empty the drain, how to wash your hands, how to record the drainage. And then there's antibiotics. We teach them how to take their medication. And so we encourage the patient. I said, you are invested in your own care. Let's together do the best job we can. And that has paid off. Of course, it takes longer. It takes more of my staff hours. You can't quite see as many patients. However, if we have excellent outcomes with our patients, we can reproduce this. And we have. And we stay at it. We do catch some seromas really early when the grains are out. We can aspirate those in the clinic. So there's all these things and mechanisms we have, but I have to be part of it. I don't get to delegate and say, you do this, you do this. We do this as a team. So when I go into the room, there's probably 2 or 3, sometimes even 4 people in the room with me taking one patient.
It's nice to know that the patients, you know, are being taken care of, and we do see the challenges, and communication between teams is very important in the clinical side, but also between the business and clinical sides. So medical necessity has become a word that I know sometimes physicians don't like to hear, because unfortunately insurance companies have their own idea of what is medically necessary, when we feel obviously a physician should be the ones that ultimately decide what is medically necessary. And you have to meet those standards of care in the clinical setting. So how do you manage that, you know, with your documentation, making sure that you try to satisfy enough for the insurance company without sacrificing the standards of care that you have?
I'm pretty sure they know everything we're doing. They know our complications. They know everything is documented. One of our HMPs, and I don't say that 8 pages is a great HMP, it's full of information and discussion. On, for instance, medical necessity would be someone who has a genetic propensity for breast malignancy, and that propensity can be anywhere from 25% up to 90%. We'll document grandmother had breast cancer, mother had breast cancer. This one doesn't necessarily, doesn't show that she's in that age range yet, but she could be. So this person is asking, Willis, I would like to go ahead and do risk reduction surgery. And so when you start talking dollars and cents, if that patient has to do an MRI for the next 20 years looking for a cancer versus going ahead and saying, listen, I'm getting close to that age, what are the odds of me doing risk reduction surgery, having a low complication rate, therefore saving the insurance company thousands and thousands of dollars? Because once you have breast cancer, it's really, really expensive. So if you're high risk and we can prevent you getting breast cancer, then we save the patient hundreds of thousands of dollars, and probably insurance hundreds of thousands of dollars. So we kind of help show the benefits of medical necessity for high-risk individuals. So that's just one example, but it takes a lot of work.
No, it does. And that's important. And, you know, when you have someone like yourself who really understands the importance of accurate, good documentation, it's not just to get paid. It's really to help the patients, you know, the true picture of what they're dealing with be seen across even service lines. You know, when they go from physician to physician, it's important that documentation be clear. And when I teach, you know, physicians about documentation improvement, one of the things I talk about that I think you have well down is showing the thought process that you have throughout your entire, you know, time with that patient. And that's really important because the insurance companies do look at that. They look at, you're ordering this test. Well, what's the rationale behind it? What other things have you looked at to justify ordering this test? Sometimes I think we look at an aspect, well, let's just order this and order this. But sometimes we don't think with the cost, you know, and that's what they're trying to control. So when an insurance company is being a gatekeeper in some ways, they're trying to control costs and really make sure the patients, do they really need this test right now? Or is there something else that can be tried? So ultimately, I think that in some ways, it's what they're trying to control, but we know sometimes they don't make it easy for physicians to take care of their patients. And you are, you know, an educator yourself. So you educate other physicians. And what are some of the things that you educate them on to help them be more efficient?
Well, some of the education. So for instance, one, you know, I'm getting ready to go back to Newport Beach in California. We have a 2 to 3 day course of teaching other docs how to do certain procedures. We'll use cadaver training to teach them how to do, you know, a lot of reconstructive maneuvers that it's not necessarily a complete mastectomy and reconstruction. We're teaching them how to use different tools in their toolbox to be better surgeons and make the best incisions for the best outcomes that will lead to the least amount of deformity and the least amount of redo operations. So, and in those teaching moments, it's a two-way street. I'm learning from my students just as much as they're learning from me. And we will teach them, yes, the literature may say you don't have to change this particular patch around the drain site, but we will teach you, if you will preemptively take care of a drain every week until that drain comes out, just like it's, you know, using clean technique and aseptic technique, you will lower your complication rate of drain site infection, which is huge. So we're always trying to teach. Now, if the literature says, hey, there's nothing that says antibiotic may be beneficial, and I'll tell you, you can read all you want, but if your outcomes are not producing what the literature is saying, then you have to change something. And so I challenge, you know, our students to, like, okay, go home and show yourself and prove yourself that the things you're learning and document everything you do with great detail in your notes, in your dictation, and when you're describing to your patient. So it's really, I think the key to all of this is really communication. And it is to communicate until people understand patient and the patient's understanding you and the family, and then our students that we're teaching. Do you understand what we're trying to teach you? So that uses lots of words, and if the hours are long in some of these teaching days, 14-hour days in the lab, get out late at night, and you do it again the next morning. So we're committed to trying to turn out just superb surgeons and tweak what they do and make sure they can do it better.
Now, Dr. Cross, recently I was able to have you quote for me in my article that I wrote for Healthcare Business Monthly for AAPC. And I got a lot of questions, you know, just about different things that we do on the coding side. And so I just wanted to highlight one of the areas that just for clarification from a physician standpoint, and you and I have had this conversation before, when you perform those ultrasounds, right? I know anatomy is so important. From a physician standpoint, when we're looking at specifically an ultrasound that is axillary based versus, you know, maybe another structure, sometimes anatomy can be an issue. When you think about your documentation, what are you trying to get across in there that shows the anatomical locations you're focusing on when you're talking about the breast axilla versus maybe a musculoskeletal situation?
Yeah, I mean, you'd think it would be obvious. Surgical oncology, breast surgeon, we're not so interested in the bony structure. Mm-hmm. Although we use the head of the humerus as a landmark, when I see that, then I know all the important structures are going to be inferior to that. So, but most of the time, you know, of course we want to look at the nodes. That's the primary reason that we're looking in the axilla, is to assess the nodes. Are they there? They are. How big are they? Are what's the cortex? What is the normal look of a lymph node? Is it suspicious? Does it need to be biopsied? And then there are some vascular things that I want to look at as well. Not all the time, but if you're getting ready to biopsy a lymph node and you see a vascular structure pulsating, then you're going to have to learn how to get to that without injuring the vessel. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's the main thing, is we're not trying to do any really musculoskeletal. You know, I can see the pec border. I can't really see the serratus really good. And so our primary goal in this is really for node assessment. And then if they come back and, you know, a few years later, the breast is gone, we go back to the nodal site to see, is there anything else going on in there? So it becomes fairly obvious what our goal is.
Absolutely. And that's really important that you said that, because one of the things I teach coders and even physicians when I'm talking about documentation is, even if you are, you know, looking at all this documentation, there is an intent there. And that particular order that is put forth is what is the focus. But you still will see physicians document these other structures, because it's important that they look at all these things while performing this specific test. So the insurance company is looking for what we call clinical indicators to support this test. And some of those clinical indicators will be other structures visualized within that test. And so those are some of the things I highlight. So I like that you pointed out, you know, you have to look at those structures, but your intent is always, as a breast surgeon, you're focused on those nodes. And that's what you're covering and you're getting reimbursed for. It's good medicine to review all those things and document everything you're seeing, even if your intent and the focus is right at the axilla. So that's great stuff. Thank you so much for clarifying that from a surgeon's standpoint, because I think it really helps coders really grasp the concepts that they're reading in those operative notes. Well, Dr. Cross, is there anything you'd like to tell our coding and billing teams out there from a physician standpoint, and final thoughts and words of wisdom?
Well, I think, you know, this is the third time I would have said this, is communication. Don't assume. I don't mind calls at all. Is this what you meant? Did you, or say, hey, I read your note. You might want to add this. We can have busy days and we can leave out one or two things that probably should have been said. But I think intent is always good. And if we feel like, you know, a code, you know, like, you know, several different ways you can do intraoperative ultrasound, which we haven't talked about that. There's not a whole lot of reimbursement for that, but it's just, that's a tool and it's incredibly important. But most of the coding that we're going to do, you know, regarding ultrasound is in the office. We will do the opposite axilla, and people go, why are you doing the opposite axilla? For several reasons. If you cannot confirm that the lymph node on the right, if it seems abnormal, but you're not sure, we'll go over and pan through the opposite axilla. We'll see a lot of people with implants, and those nodes can be swollen just because of the implant. And so We'll do a comparison. It's valuable information to us. We're trying to establish clarity that there's no bilateral disease. And sometimes we do pick up on some abnormal things. So that's a new thing that you and I haven't really talked about is opposite, if there's no known disease in the opposite axilla, should you still code for that? Should you still bill for that? My note will clarify, we are ultrasounding the opposite side for clarification of the other side, and the patient may be complaining of, well, I feel something on the opposite side. So that's where the communication comes through, and not just the negate that we coded for visualization of the opposite side. And we will do that in our note as well. So that's just kind of an interesting side for us to pay attention to and to talk with our coders about.
Excellent, excellent. And to all of our listeners, please stay tuned. At the end of the episode, I will have some FAQs. Thank you, Dr. Cross, for joining today and taking the time out of seeing your patients to talk with me today and our listeners so we can learn more about what you do, your important work, and how physicians and coders and billing staff can all work together to make sure patients have access to the treatment that they so desperately need. Thank you again. Our sponsors over at OncoSpark created the Spark Advisory Network, backed by technology tools and services through their Code Interceptor program. This helps teams work smarter and not harder. Unpaid claims are wasting your time and costing your practice money. Most denials are due to coding and billing inaccuracies because staff may lack the proper education or are just spread way too thin. This is preventable with focused and uninterrupted verification. Our Code Interceptor experts will intercept your claims before they are submitted to ensure accuracy and completeness. This will reduce hours of working unnecessary denials and appeals while increasing timely payments you need to care for your patients. With current trends and staffing shortages, our team can create confidence and consistency. Contact OncoSpark today for a no-obligation consultation. Take back your revenue today. Visit www.oncospark.com. Well, it's time for our Q&A, and we're going to dig in and talk about some of the common questions that we get from our physicians and how we can answer them today. Sometimes I do get questions from surgeons, and I wanted to share some of the questions that they've asked me, and of course, what I can do and what we can do as coders to provide those answers to our surgeons. So let's look at some of these questions and see how we can answer them. I think one of the questions I get a lot is having to do with that decision to perform major surgery. In the E&M guidelines, we know that that is one of the areas on the risk table, right? The risk area, that column there. When they make a decision to perform major surgery, one of the surgeons asked me, this seems to cause red flags to pop up, especially if it is not applied appropriately. When do we use this and how? Well, this is very simple, right? We know from a clinical standpoint, as a surgeon, you make a decision to perform a major surgery. Now, your decision to perform that, your patient needing this, is your professional decision, right? I think sometimes it gets confused as to what if the patient doesn't want to go through with that procedure? What if they decide not to do it? Well, on the E&M side, when you're leveling out your service, that is part of your decision making. So when you make a decision to perform major surgery, that gets counted in that decision making. Now, where it falls on the risk table will depend on what else you tell us, right? So when it comes to the decision for major surgery, we have elements such as what are the risks involved? Have you identified those risks for us? That's very, very important. So what we want to see in documentation is, of course, that official decision that this patient needs surgery. The fact that it's major surgery will be dictated by your documentation talking about what type of surgery it is. And we look at this from the clinical side, not the global period side, where what Medicare or payers say is a 90 or 10 day, whether it's major or minor in those instances. It's major from the clinical standpoint, what a clinical person would identify as major. And so we think about things like the chance for infection. How is it an open procedure? And by opening the patient up, what are some of the risks to that? And some of those things will come into play to really identify it as a major surgery. Now, on the coding side for surgery, sometimes I get a lot of questions from surgeons about co-surgery, assistant surgery. I think for surgeons, this is always a challenge, right? So the question is, can we ever bill for an assistant? Well, as an assistant surgeon, you will at times, as a surgeon, assist another surgeon, right? So if you are an MD, a DO, you are an actual surgeon, right? You will assist sometimes. And there are certain areas or parts of that procedure that you're going to assist with. And of course, you're both going to bill the same CPT code, the same surgical code, right? Because you are both working on the same surgery. And maybe you are just assisting them while they're performing the entire procedure, right? Now, when it comes to co-surgery, it may be a little bit different concept. So you are still going to bill the same CPT code, but maybe you're just helping with the approach. There's a certain part of the surgery that you are helping with, that you are both serving as co-surgeons. You're both doing it, right? So one part of the surgery you're doing, and maybe the bulk of the rest of the procedure another surgeon is doing. But when it comes to that approach, you're both working on the surgery and you're both going to bill that procedure code. But maybe the rest of the another code that's being billed will be billed by the other surgeon. So what are you working on? What are you both working on together? You're going to have to identify that in that surgery for us. So modifier 22 is something I get a lot of questions about. So when and how is it appropriate to use this? Well, this is something where it's extensive time is something that you wouldn't normally have to do, right? So you've spent extensive time or maybe something complex has occurred with the patient, maybe their body habitus, or a challenge, a complication has occurred that's increased the time that you have to spend with that patient. So it's very important that you identify those challenges in the operative note, identify the time specifically spent. Was there excessive bleeding? Was there difficulty with just the patient in general that increased the time or intensity of that service where normally it would not have done so, right? And we know sometimes there's codes that are bundled into other procedures and our inclination is to let's slap a 22 on there because this procedure is bundled and we want to capture it, right? And a lot of times, especially in general surgery, that can be the case where, especially with lysis of adhesions, we want to see that extensive lysis of adhesions being captured, even though we know it's bundled into the main part of the procedure. There are times where it could be relevant with a 22 modifier if there's extensive lysis of adhesions as documented, and it's very clear as to why we are asking for more money, right? Because ultimately, it's what's happening, right? We are asking for more money from the insurance company. It's an increased service. So they're going to add a little bit extra reimbursement, if approved, of course, on top of that. So they're going to require documentation. They're going to have see the reasons laid out specifically. And we will put some information in our show notes for those of us that are interested in learning a little bit more about the proper use of modifier 22. An example in the hospital again. You're asked for a consultation on a hospital patient that you have seen in the past, whether in the clinic or even in the hospital. When can you bill a new patient consultation versus an established patient consultation? So here's where the tricky thing comes, because with consultations, there's no new or established, right? So when it comes to in the hospital, for instance, it's initial versus subsequent. So when we look at those concepts, it might be difficult sometimes to switch our brain from in the office, we're new established, in the hospital, it's initial subsequent. So it's by the stay. So you are seeing a patient that's been admitted, right? And they have, of course, called you in as a consultant. You're going to bill your admit code because we know with Medicare, many payers, they don't accept consult codes. So the 99221-23 that we know has now been brought into the 2021 guidelines will be reported for that initial visit, right? That you see the patient for. And then if you see them again during that same stay, right? Then we have those subsequent codes that we would use. Whether it's inpatient admission or it's an observation situation. So I think going forward, we can help our surgeons understand the difference between new established in the office setting and then initial subsequent. It's, you know, in the office setting, it's different visits, right? Different times that come in throughout that 3 years. But when it comes to the hospital side, it's by stay, that admission or that observation, right? Whether admitted to observation, admitted to inpatient status. Whatever the situation is, it's by that stay. So how many times are you seeing that patient in that stay in the hospital? So hopefully that helps alleviate some of those questions. And I get a lot of questions, you know, some basic ones I think will help a lot of different surgeons. There are some unique questions to certain specialties. So if you're out there, you're a surgeon, a physician, or maybe you are working in a clinic as a practice manager, or even a coder, and you run across these challenges, questions from your surgeons that you just can't seem to answer, please reach out to us at OncoSpark. We have a team of subject matter experts, and we provide services, you know, to help streamline some of the processes, understand some of these nuances. We use data and technology to help solve your issues, your challenges. And we use our subject matter experts to provide education along with those data reviews. So please reach out to us at www.oncospark.com for any questions. You can reach a subject matter expert at www.sparkadvisorynetwork.com. So check us out. And thank you for listening to the episode today. As always, our goal is to educate. We know that there are so many challenges in healthcare, and I always appreciate those that take the time out of their day, their schedule, to listen to this podcast we put out there for your benefit. And we love teaching, educating our healthcare communities. So please reach out to us if you have any challenges that you would like covered on a future podcast. I want to thank, as always, our sponsors over at OncoSpark for providing an opportunity for us to educate in this way. And thank you to our amazing podcast producer, Gabriel Fass with Highland Productions. Until next time.
Thanks for joining us this week on Healthcare Crossroads. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss a show. Thank you to our sponsors at OncoSpark. OncoSpark is a technology-enabled revenue cycle management company. They help you effectively manage claims data with technology solutions. Check out their website to learn more at www.oncospark.com. Thank you, OncoSpark.